These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Today, we continue our discussion about starting a family. The subject this time is adoption. Whether you're bringing home your first joyous bundle or adding to your brood, what should you know about adopting in the 49th state? I'll be talking today with people who work with local adoption programs. We'll go into the living rooms of two Alaska families who have adopted children, and we'll report on step-parent adoptions as well this hour. Stay with us for that and more on Kids These Days. Adopting a child or children can be a beautiful experience for entire families and the kids they take in. There are many things to consider when adopting. Should you adopt internationally or locally? Is an open adoption something you're open to? We'll tackle these questions and many more on today's show. And while we do that, we want to hear from you. Do you have an adoption story you'd like to share? Are you going through the process right now? What are your thoughts and feelings on this subject? Well, there are lots of ways to tell us. Write to us, that's mail@kidsthesedays.org, or you can comment on our website as well as through social media. Head to our Facebook page, that's Kids These Days Radio. Joining me for today's discussion are three guests. On the phone from Juneau, we're talking with Carrie Lee Peets. Carrie Lee is the Social Service Program Officer who oversees the Resource Family Unit at the Office of Children's Services. Carrie Lee has been a child protection social worker since 1994 and has worked in Alaska's Office of Children's Services for 6 years. During her tenure with OCS, Carrie Lee's worked exclusively with permanency issues for children. Thanks to you, Carrie Lee, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Susan Bomolaski has been the Executive Director of Catholic Social Services since 2006. Prior to leading Catholic Social Services, Susan was the Executive Director for St. Peter St. Joseph's Children's Home, a home for abused and neglected children in San Antonio, Texas. And thanks to you, Dr. Bomolaski, for being with us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
And also in the studio with us is Sarah Blanning. Sarah Blanning is a licensed master social worker and has worked for Catholic Social Services since September 2011. Sarah is the coordinator for the Infant Adoption Program and the Waiting Child Program and provides assistance to adoptees and birth parents post-adoption. Prior to her move to Alaska, Sarah worked for her local child welfare agency in Pennsylvania. Thanks to you, Sarah, for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, to start the conversation off, I'd like to read from a brochure that comes from Catholic Social Services, and it's part of the How Do We Get Started part. So I think that this would be a great place for us to start as well. And in the How to Get Started, there are some interesting ideas in there, like openness and adoption, transracial adoption, and understanding birth parents. This is part of a workshop that your organization offers. So, Dr. Bomolaski, maybe we can start with you. How does one get started with Catholic Social Services, for example, if they're interested in adopting?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. A lot of people come in at all different phases in the question, I think. Some are just contemplating adopting. Some have been thinking about it for quite a while and have decided to call us. Some of them may have adopted before in different ways and come to us. So usually it's either a phone call or they go to our website and contact us in that way. And the first step's usually a conversation with our adoption coordinator and then attendance at the workshop.
And Sarah Blanning, you are the Infant Adoption Program and the Child Waiting Program Coordinator. I'm just curious, you know, can you explain what those two different positions are, those two different roles that you fill? What do you do in those programs?
Yeah, they obviously have a lot of similarities, but a lot of differences too. The Infant Adoption Program is for people that are interested in adopting a newborn. We do work with kiddos up to the age of about 3, but not the most common. Generally, newborns are up to a couple months old, and it's a domestic infant adoption program. The Waiting Child Program is something something that we started and we're still in the process of really building up for families here in Alaska that are interested in adopting children in the foster care systems throughout the country. Those families need an adoption coordinator to act on their behalf, provide the appropriate information to those states, and really help to get in a mutual agreement between both parties, and that's the role that we fill.
So this would be, so the difference there, explain that to me again, the child waiting versus the infant child. What are the differences in who that kid is, for example?
Yeah, the infant adoption program is going to be little ones that are here in Alaska. These are going to be birth parents that came to our agency for whatever reason. They do not feel that they're able to parent themselves and they want to select one of our families to raise their child, where the waiting child program is really focusing on children that have already been taken into protective custody by their respective states and are in need of a forever home. And those states have reached out through the various adoption exchanges to locate a family, and we got lots of willing ones up here in Alaska.
Interesting. Carrie Lee in Juneau, with the Office of Children's Services, tell us about how do prospective adoptive parents get involved with your agency and its options for adoption?
Parents can get involved with the Office of Children's Services in a variety of ways. It's always our goal at the Office of Children's Services to safely maintain kids in their own home with their families, but that's not always possible, and sometimes placement's needed. We do have licensed foster parents and licensed foster homes that are already working with our program to provide a safe, stable home for children. We also find in Alaska that a lot of relatives or community members, when they find out a child has come into care, are really interested in helping that child that they already know. So we also have a great deal of unlicensed relative providers or family members who get licensed particularly to care for one of those children. And so when a family comes into OCS to get licensed, there's definitely a pretty lengthy process for the foster care licensing process. There's also background check things that happen for unlicensed relatives as well as some assessment. But when their decision is really to be adoptive, there are particular things they need to do for the Office of Children's Services. One of them is to have an adoption home study and to get some of those things in place, and we help them to figure out how those systems work. And so for families, there are a lot of options, and usually it's a matter of a first phone call to us, just talking that through. We might send them through our orientation program on what it means to be foster or adoptive parents and try to give them as much education as we can and talk about all the different options for private or public adoption.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we do need to focus on process here a little bit, too, because we're talking, because we have, you know, these different ways of adopting children in our state, there are some different ways that families get involved and get started in that process. So let's take infant adoption first. And maybe we even go, you know, to the beginning, which is to the woman who's expecting a child, who's considering adoption for her child. And Sarah Blanning, tell us a little bit about the women who your organization works with who are considering giving up their kids for adoption.
Yeah, a lot of the birth parents that we work with come from all walks of life. I think some statistics that usually surprise people is often our birth moms are a little bit older. Our average age is usually in their late 20s or early 30s. A lot of people really anticipate it to be teenagers or really young women, and that's not really what we see. Oftentimes, these women are already parenting other children, and the idea of adding just one more mouth to feed is more than they're going to be able to do. And I think that really goes back to their decision to pursue adoption is really a decision made out of love, and they really want the best for their child, and they know that they're not in a position to provide that. So they come to us. We have a pregnancy support advocate that works with these women to, number one, really talk about what their options are and first figure out, are they interested in parenting? Do they want to parent this child? Can we connect them to some resources in the community or locate some supports for them that will allow them to parent? If that's not something that's going to work, do they have a family member that they would like to parent their child? If they're Alaska Native or Native American, is their tribe a resource to help them parent? And if all of those options have kind of been exhausted without coming to a solution, then we start talking about our adoptive families and helping them to understand what our families have to offer. the really great thing about our program is that the birth parents get to select the adoptive family based on getting to know some information about them. And the reasons they pick families vary from the very funny reasons to obviously things that are a lot more emotional or detailed. And once they pick that family, we start to move forward on the process. And it's a really beautiful thing when they really connect.
So you say that the birth moms are able to find, you know, they select the adoptive parents.
Yes.
And they're able to find out information about the adoptive parents. How does that work exactly? Do they interview? Do they meet? Do they get together, go to dinner? How does it work?
Well, that happens later on. Initially, our adoptive parents make a portfolio that consists of a letter to the birth moms and to the birth fathers, basically introducing themselves and kind of giving the birth parents a picture of the life that they would offer to the child. There's also some photos so that, you know, put faces to names. That's always important. And then the adoptive family has an opportunity to answer some questions about themselves. Some relate to those really tough adoption issues, and some are a lot more fun, like, you know, how creative are you? And or do you have any musical ability? And things like that. And based on that whole portfolio, the birth parents get to select a family, and then we move forward with an initial meeting for the both sides to get to know each other a little bit and make sure it's something that they're both comfortable with and want to move forward on.
So how are the adoptive parents in the case of Catholic Social Services? And then also, this is maybe something that you can answer too, Carrie Lee and Juno from the Office of Children's Services. You mentioned home study. How are the families sort of vetted, or, you know, how do they try out, or how are they made sure that these are good, safe, loving homes that the kids ultimately end up in?
Yeah, it's a pretty extensive process for sure. The first thing when a family contacts me is figuring out what route do they envision a child joining their home. You know, as Susan had mentioned, there's a lot of families that come to us very, very early on and have just started their adoption journey and have a lot of questions. So I always ask them, if you were to adopt a child, what does that child look like to you? How old do you think the child would be? How do you envision that child joining your family and determining, is an infant program right for you? Would you like to adopt internationally? What about from the foster care system? For families that choose to adopt through our infant program, they do go through an educational workshop focusing on those topics you mentioned, the understanding who our birth parents are, developing those skills to adopt a child of a different culture or of a different race, and then understanding what openness is. We are a program that really values that. So once the families finish that workshop, they have a big decision to make. Is our program right for them? Are their values in line with our philosophy? Once that part is finished and they've decided they do want to move forward, long application process, you know, those background checks and financial information and making sure that they have their life in order to move forward. And then the home study process, which is a really detailed assessment of who they are, what are they like, what's their history, what's their relationship, and why do they want to adopt?
And the home, why is it called home study? Do the agencies actually go into the home and study it?
We do. We go to their house. It's two, usually at least two separate visits where we sit down on their couch or at the kitchen table and just talk about who they are.
Carrie Lee, is the home study, when you talk about that with the Office of Children's Services, is it similar?
It is very similar. In fact, we contract with provide grants to agencies across the state, and one of them is Catholic Social Services that we utilize in the Anchorage and South Central region. And so their home study is actually very similar to the process we use across the state. And we could get families in a couple of different ways through OCS. Like Sarah talked about, we definitely have people that will call for all kinds of different reasons, just really initially inquiring, and we might refer them to somebody like the Alaska Center for Resource Families or the Catholic Social Service Adoption Program or another program in the state to get more information. We also have our Alaska Adoption Exchange, which often we get families who may or may not live in Alaska that may or may not already have a home study that just want more information about children who are waiting and listed on our exchange. And then lastly, of course, is our current resource families who have children placed with them that really want to be the adoptive permanent placement for those children. And we do use a home study process, which includes a criminal background check for all adult household members, 16 and over. It also includes child protection check and other background things, as well as going into the home and really assessing that family's ability to meet the long-term needs of this particular child, taking into account those special needs for that child.
Mm-hmm. And when you say resource family, I'm assuming that that means a family that's interested or involved in providing resources to children. Is that right? Or what's the definition of that?
Yeah, when I talk about a resource family in the Office of Children's Services, that really means our licensed foster families, our unlicensed relative caregivers, adoptive or guardianship families that continue to access services through our office. So it can be a variety of different types of families. But all of those families either are or would like to be providing assistance to children in need and provide a safe, stable home.
Okay. Well, since we're talking about terminology, I also want to get back to a concept that we've referred to a couple times so far in the discussion but haven't really talked about specifically, and that is the open adoption process or method model versus what's been called the traditional model. And maybe, Susan, I can invite you to talk about that.
Sure. The traditional model, I guess, or the model that used to be in practice was the closed adoption. And Catholic Social Services started our adoption program in 1967. And for many years, we were closed, which is where the, you know, birth parent would bring their baby in and say, find a family for this child, and then leave the picture. The records are sealed for a long time, in our case, 100 years. We have records from 1967 that are still sealed. As Sarah said, now what we do is the people that are interested in adoption make a portfolio. The birth parent selects from that portfolio, and then they establish a relationship. And that relationship can be having Thanksgiving dinner together, or it can be exchanging pictures every few years, or it can be even less than that. But that's how we define open adoption. So the adoption is not a surprise to anybody. There's no legal matters that have to take place in order for the adoptive child to find out who their birth parent is. And so it takes that aspect out of the picture. But it's a big change. When adoptions were closed, we would do in the first 20 years, probably 600 adoptions, you know, 30, 40 adoptions a year. Last year, we did 8.
Oh.
So.
And you think that it's the change to the open
adoptions?
Yeah, I think,
I think there's the societal changes around single parents raising their children has been a huge change over 40 years. So there's various reasons, for that change. But it's, people think we might do a lot of adoptions. We don't. If we do a dozen, you know, that's a lot in a year. Now, each one of those takes a significant amount of time. But the open adoption is certainly, the research shows that for everybody in the adoption triad, which we call the child that's being born, the adoptive family, and the birth parents, having that openness there is just it's healthier for everybody involved.
And how, I imagine you see that through outcomes. So what, the better outcomes for the child eventually if the adoption has been open from the very beginning? Or, how is it, how does the research show that it's better?
Well, that's a great question. I might have to defer to Sarah if she has research on that. Well, because we don't follow the children. I mean, we do anecdotally. People will come back to us and talk about it. But we see the other way. So someone that's maybe 39 or 40 now contacts us to locate their birth parent, and reuniting when someone is a 30 or 40 year old can be very difficult in finding out this news and things like that. So open, healthy communications, the relationships are facilitated better.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, did you have anything to add to that?
I think that what Susan mentions about people that are in their 30s or 40s contacting us, I think really gives me so much more respect for doing open adoptions now. When I talk to somebody that, was adopted in the 70s or the 80s, and I can share even the tiniest bit of information with them and hear how excited they are, it's wonderful and it's a great feeling to share that. But at the same time, I feel so terribly that they had to wait that long to find out that their birth mom loved musical instruments, and so do they. So I think that that's really where we see a lot of it. Openness really is, most importantly, it's best for the child. They're able to get really accurate information. They don't have to worry about feeling torn between their adoptive parents or birth parents, because everybody really participates in a relationship of mutual respect and communication. It's really great for the birth parents, because their biggest concern is that their child's not being cared for and that their child's not loved. And when they can get that reassurance through some visits or through contact or through pictures, it really makes them remember that as hard as that decision was for them, they knew it was the right one. And then it's good for adoptive parents because they can answer their child's questions as the child gets older and has more and more of them. They actually know the information and can pass it along.
Mm-hmm. Carrie Lee, do you have a perspective on open adoptions?
I do have some thoughts on that. So I just wanted to say that I am in agreement with what Sarah and Susan said. I think the field of child protection and adoption have really changed their focus, as Susan talked about, that it used to be a world of closed adoptions. And I think that we have really started to identify in the last several years the importance of family connections, the importance of culture for children, the importance of really knowing who they are. And with that, that's definitely a goal for OCS, like Catholic Social Services talked about, that it is important, and that relationship needs to be an ongoing relationship, but it may be different for every child or family. For some families, there may be reasons that that relationship really can't continue in any fashion. For some, it may be a photo or a letter periodically, and for other families, that definitely may be ongoing contact, depending on the needs of the child and the biological parents' issues and the adoptive families' opinions as well. So it really is something that we've seen a positive shift in. And I think as you talk to older youth or you hear some of the stories, it's very apparent that children do want to know where they come from and they want to know what their connections are. And especially, you know, with siblings and extended family, that those are very important relationships for our children, no matter if they're in the foster care system or a private adoption system or something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the perfect time to meet Dale, Karen, and Maya, our producer Sarah Gonzalez's next-door neighbors. Together, they shared with Kids These Days why they say open adoption makes sense to them.
My name is Maya, and I'm 8 years old.
My name is Karen, and I'm 50-something.
Hi, I'm Dale.
I go to Government Hill, and my favorite thing to do at Government Hill is art.
She's an 8-year-old wonder, a tour de force, a kid who is always on the go. She wakes up happy every day and goes to sleep happy. So we're having a great time with her.
Her liveliness, her happiness, just watching a kid grow and develop and having watched it all happen from the beginning is just very amazing.
She was 7 months pregnant, and so I went with her on a couple of prenatal visits. And, you know, we talked about whether I would be there at the birth, and she said that would be fine. But things go up and down during pregnancy, and, you know, there were moments of doubt. And, you know, at the last minute we thought, well, maybe we won't be there. But then, of course, that morning she did call us and say, where are you? Where are you? So we went to the, I went to the operating room where she had a C-section, and I was there during the birth of Maya.
It was a lot of relief because we'd went through a lot of tension being at the hospital and meeting people and wondering if the birth father might show up. And then we ended up taking the birth mother back to her home. And so there was a sort of a tearful goodbye there. And so it was nice to be actually in our own home with our own new daughter, learning to take care of her and love her.
Well, it seemed like if you didn't do an open adoption from the beginning, then you had a lot of explaining to do later on. It was better just to be free and open and share information. It just seemed the natural thing to do.
I felt like it's just kind of a normal way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that we have answers for Maya's questions. Well, we talk about a birth mother mm-hmm. ever since Maya was born. Mm-hmm. She's known that, and yeah, and it's just another part of our family.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been curious about your birth father, haven't you?
And that's someone we don't have a lot of information
on. Isabella's father.
And Isabella's father. Your half-sisters have different fathers. And so that's, it's been a great avenue to talk about reproduction and sexuality and to start learning about those things right away mm-hmm. because... those are things that can help kids understand mm-hmm. where they're coming from. Some of Maya's favorite books are about where did I come from.
My mom puts me to bed at night, reads me stories.
We know everything about raising a child. We know nothing about pregnancy. You know, so we started at zero and went forward. So the things that, you know, the biological birth part, you know, part of it, we have no experience with, but we didn't lose a bit from that. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a tiny infant to take care of and watched her blossom and grow and blossom.
Yeah. You know, the loss of the pregnancy experience and not breastfeeding, those are real things that adoptive parents, you know, some can overcome some of that and some can't. I think it's really good to go and tell everybody that you're planning to adopt, because then they do start treating you more like a prospective parent. And that was very helpful, you know, because our friends were involved and, you know, could understand, oh, we got a call, but then that person changed their mind. And so then there's the disappointment. And I think it's really good to put it out there, because then people will respond. Since Maya's joined our family, well, we probably eat meals more regularly than we used to. And we just never stop anymore. Before, things were pretty quiet. And there's never any problem getting up in the morning. And you know, our circle of friends and everything has just grown a lot, because we meet so many really interesting people through Maya, through her friends, and just having a family opens you up to so many other areas of life that you wouldn't be involved in.
And I've learned to know a lot of other kids and get to watch them develop and compare them with Maya, and also just watch them grow as a little community of kids. It'll be wonderful seeing Anchorage in 20 years when they take over.
Karen, Dale, and Maya live in Anchorage and recently spoke with their neighbor and our producer, Sarah Gonzalez. This is Kids These Days on this listener-supported public radio station. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and we're talking about adopting children in Alaska this hour. My guests are Carrie Lee Peets, Sarah Blanning, and Dr. Susan Bomolaski. And Dr. Bomolaski, actually, I'd like to invite you to comment quickly before we need to take a quick break about that story.
Sure, what a great story. And I actually had the privilege of serving as a pregnancy support counselor in a window of time when we didn't have one in the program. And the experience that I went through with the birth mom and the family was similar to that. I mean, seeing they were there, the adoptive family was there when the child was born, and seeing that bonding at that time is pretty amazing. And also the idea that Dale and Karen spoke about the openness and how they talk about it all the time, you know, it emphasized how important that is. So, and you could hear in Maya's voice with her giggling, you know, what a joy, you mm-hmm. know, what a wonderful addition to their family and a wonderful experience for all involved. And I like what she said about telling people that you're expecting. That does have up and downs that we do see sometimes, because sometimes the birth parents change their mind, you know, have a change of heart, and the adoptive family has to deal with that. So having a support group is wonderful to get you through that too, as well as when the baby comes home.
In talking about change of heart and some of those other considerations, and something we'll get back to after we take a quick break. I'm Shanna Sheehy. This is Kids These Days. Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. This program airs on 7 stations in the great state of Alaska. We appreciate all of our listeners and invite you to continue this conversation all week long online. The production and distribution of this program is made possible through a partnership with KSKA FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Talk back to us and find out more about our partners and our funders at kidsthesedays.org. After a quick break, we'll be back to hear more from today's guests, and still to come, we learn about what's involved when step-parents want to adopt, and we'll meet another family with adopted kids, so stay with us.
And you are the mother, of your baby child, the one to whom you gave life. And you have your choices, and these are what make man great, his ladder to the stars. But you are not alone in this, and you are not alone in this. As brothers, we will stand and we'll hold your hand, hold hold your hand. But I will tell the night and whisper, lose your sight.
Next time on Kids These Days, we're hosting a conversation you may have or hear a lot. How do you balance your time these days? Many parents are working and kids themselves have packed schedules, and most of us have ongoing responsibilities on the job and in the home. How do you do it all? Have you struck or do you struggle toward a healthy and happy work and life balance? That's the conversation next time on Kids These Days. We're back. This is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today I'm talking with Dr. Susan Bomolaski and Sarah Blanning from Catholic Social Services and Carrie Lee Peets from the Alaska Office of Children's Services. We're talking about adoption in Alaska this hour. And Carrie Lee Peets and Juno, I'd like to get you back in the conversation. Maybe, you know, since you have the perspective of working with families, can you walk us through the experience of, say, a foster family who's had a child in their custody as a foster child for that six-month period that you've mentioned before is necessary, and then the family wants to go through with adopting the child. What considerations go into that process, and maybe even how long does it take for that process to go through?
Well, and the time frame really does depend on a lot of individual factors related to the child and the resource family and the biological family for that child. But when a child comes into care, their initial plan is almost always to reunify with their family, and our office would work to do that. We would, in the meantime, probably have a child in the foster care setting. If we can have them with a relative or somebody in their home community, that's always ideal for us.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of resource families, of course, would know the biological family, and we would continue to encourage them to have that ongoing contact and help the child deal with that relationship as well. At some point in the OCS system, it's probably about the 9 month to 1 year time frame. If a child hasn't been able to reunify, we'll do a team decision making meeting or a permanency placement conference, and we'll talk about the case plan for that child and their family. And if there's a determination that they're not going to be able to return home in a timely manner, then we would definitely look at adoption as another alternative. If there have been family members that have expressed interest, we would look at those again. But often that adoption ends up happening by that resource family, which could be a relative to the child or may not be. Once we identify that they're the adoptive family, we would refer them for a home study. Susan did talk about what that process looks like, but the home study is a really in-depth assessment of that family's ability to provide long-term, stable, permanent family for the child and really be able to make a lifelong commitment. Again, I talked really briefly about the background check and the ongoing OCS contact that would happen over those 6 months, but we make sure that a child is in a home for 6 months before we'd ever finalize, because we want to make sure things have stabilized. And if there are services that we need to provide, we want to make sure the family or that child has those and has an opportunity to learn enough about each other to really make that decision. So through those team meetings, which would include our tribal partners, if it's a native child, mm-hmm. It would include a guardian ad litem in most cases when the court's involved, a guardian ad litem is appointed. It would include that entire team along with the youth or child, the resource family, and in a lot of cases the biological family. To make a decision about what's really in the best interest of the child. And if that's determined and we have a positive home study, then that's when we'd start talking about adoption.
Mm-hmm. In the case of, say, an older child, you talk about the team that comes together to consider the best interest of the child. In the case of an older child, is the child, him or herself, ever invited into that conversation?
Definitely. And it's one of those conversations that, first off, we like to have them at those meetings and to be a part of that team and talk about their case plan. But for children 14 and over, we also, a judge is going to want their input on the adoption as well. So they're actually going to attend the adoption hearing, and the judge is going to look for them to be in agreement with that adoption plan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Carrie Lee Peets and Juno. Before the break, Dr. Susan Bomolaski, you mentioned a change of heart. If a mother carrying a child has a change of heart after the child's been born, in the case of an adoption proceeding, I'd like you to pick back up on that thought and talk a little bit about what does that mean, especially when it comes to parents who are waiting for placement or have just had a placement.
Sure, and Sarah addressed this earlier that, you know, the adoptive family and the birth parent would have met. You know, they would have exchanged the portfolio. But what we do at CSS, and that's why we have a pregnancy support advocate in addition to Sarah's position as the infant adoption coordinator, is the birth mom has to have someone that's talking just to her, and we want to honor her wishes, even if those wishes are after the child is born, for whatever reason it might be. Maybe a family member steps forward after the child is born, or, you know, whatever it might be, that she might change her mind, and she has that right. There's a 10-day relinquishment period, 10 days before she signs and relinquishes her rights, actually, to Catholic Social Services. We pick up those rights during that six-month time period, and that's what we call a change of heart, that she has changed her mind and her heart about what's going on with her child. And, you know, it can be very difficult for the adoptive family because they've planned for this and, you know, maybe have told other people, and it's just, you know, that unsurety coming up. So when that happens, somebody might decide to re-enter our adoption pool, and that takes a lot of counseling and a lot of support around that also.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah Blanning, you do offer some counseling services with Catholic Social Services. So do you have some firsthand experience with women who have a change of heart and then the families who are sort of, you know, left with having to consider their options if a woman does change her mind?
Yeah, it's a really interesting change in power, really. Whenever an adoption is moving forward as planned, it's usually the birth parents that are, you know, generally very upset. They're grieving the loss of the child, and the adoptive parents are the ones that are full of joy and excitement. And when a birth parent has a change of heart, it kind of swaps those roles and kind of puts people into a different perspective. You know, the adoptive families really have to really look within themselves and figure out the best way to kind of manage that risk in that initial period before the relinquishment waiting period has ended. You know, some families might do a lot better with not telling a lot of people in their family or in their support group about the adoption until that risky period has ended, where others, it might really be best for them to tell lots of people. So if there is a change, they have that support. So I kind of outline that with all of my families so that they know themselves better than anybody else does, and they need to really look within themselves and talk with each other and figure out what's going to be the best route. Because not knowing in advance if a change of heart will happen, how are we going to best be able to protect ourselves and have the support that we need if that were to happen?
Do you have an idea of how frequently that might happen with your program?
You know, it doesn't happen that often, but it is absolutely there. I think what we see most often is a birth parent that comes to us and is interested in selecting one of our families. And our pregnancy support advocate really works quite a bit with the birth parents to make sure, is this really a decision that you're comfortable with? Why are you making this decision? And really figuring out, is it something that they are comfortable with yet, or are they kind of reacting to just the stress of the moment? So what we'll see a lot of times is a birth parent that comes to us and is really, really excited about the prospect of adoption. And then after kind of talking about what their options are, they back off and decide, you know what, I think I'd really like to parent. So that's something we see much more often than actually moving forward with an adoption plan, the child being placed in the adoptive home, although it is definitely out there.
Susan?
There's also, even when the birth mother has made the right choice for her and her circumstances, there's a natural grieving that occurs. And I remember the birth mom that I was working with called me, was very upset. I think I made the wrong decision. What should I do? And so I met with her and we talked it through. you know, and she realized she had made the right decision for her and the child, but it's, you know, it's just a natural part of the process and that grieving that might happen. So that's, again, where our pregnancy support advocate would come in and why it's important to have those two roles in the whole process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another thing that we often do in that initial 10-day waiting period while the birth parents still have the ability to change their minds is help facilitate a visit between the birth parents and the adoptive family and the child, because sometimes that's all they need to just be reminded, hey, this family really does love my child, and look, they have everything they need. They have a diaper bag. I don't have a diaper bag. That wouldn't have even crossed my mind. So sometimes that really helps them solidify the decision that they've made.
Well, this is Kids These Days, and today the conversation is about adoption and starting a family. You can take part in the discussion online, chime in on our Facebook page, or directly on our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm in the studio with Dr. Susan Bomolaski and Sarah Blanning from Catholic Social Services. And with us on the phone is Carrie Lee Peets. She's with the Office of Children's Services in Juneau. And during the course of this conversation, in Catholic Social Services, for example, in, you know, I referenced a flyer that you have with some general information, and in it there's reference to transracial adoption. And Carrie Lee Peets in Juneau has also mentioned some considerations, some special considerations that go into the adoption of, in particular, Alaska Native children that go around the Indian Child Welfare Act and so forth. And I want to talk about that, but first I think it's important for us to hear this. Throughout today's show, we're hearing the personal stories of some Alaskans who have adopted children. Next, we'll hear from an Anchorage couple who have adopted two little girls through Catholic Social Services. Both of their kids are Alaska Native.
Paula Dobbin.
John Reed. Well, we have Olive, who's 2 and 5 months, and she's showing us her two fingers. And Drew, who's 9 months. Olive is Tsimshian, and Drew is Inupiaq. And Drew is very active and clearly very interested in the microphone. And they're wonderful little girls. We're having a great time raising them.
I've been thinking about it for a really long time, and it just finally seemed like, you know, I'd kind of done a lot of career stuff, and then I'd gotten a master's degree, and it was kind of like this was the next big challenge, you know? So after I'd gotten some important things that I wanted to do in my own life out of the way, I was kind of ready to do something like this.
Paula had done a lot of looking into international adoption, and, you know, we were thinking about it, and then we found out about CSS, and we went to the workshop, and it just seemed really right for us, the kind of, you know, what being local, being Alaskans, seemed like the process was a little more straightforward and less sort of tenuous in the sort of long run, and it sort of felt right for us.
With Drew, her birth mother has come to visit her a few times, and then with Olive, we have Facebook and email contact with her birth grandmother and birth mother, and recently her birth mother has expressed interest in meeting us and her. So I think it's really advantageous for the children, for the adoptees, because they will know, you know, their heritage, and they'll have, you know, direct links to their birth relatives and possibly an extended family, you know, depending on how it works out.
Tomorrow we have our court appointment for the finalization for Drew's adoption. Adoption, that's right. And if everything goes well, then everything that will be finished with the legal aspects of the adoption, and Drew will legally be part of the family at that point.
I mean, we're conscious of the fact that, you know, we're raising two children who are of different cultures than we are. And, I mean, we both take really seriously the fact, and we're really honored by the fact that we have two Alaska Native children, because, I mean, I've always been very interested in Native cultures, and, you know, as a journalist, covered Alaska Native Corporation, so I kind of feel like I know something about where these girls are coming from. But in Olive's case, like we said, she's Tsimshian, and luckily there's a very active Tsimshian dance troupe here in Anchorage, and so we go to their rehearsals and their performances as often as we can, and she's really fascinated by the drumming and the singing and the regalia that they wear, and, you know, we're hoping to get her to, when, you know, right now she's a little shy, but towards the end of the rehearsal she warms up, but she clearly really likes it, And so we hope to continue to do that and get to know other members of her tribe and, you know, it's hopefully someday, you know, take her to the village where she's from originally. And in Drew's case, you know, she's still an infant, so we haven't made real active efforts yet to connect her to her tribe, but you know, I'm sure that we will, either through dancing or through other cultural activities, you know. And we do go to the Native Heritage Center often, and I have a good friend who's Alaska Native who's helpful in terms of advice and things like that, so... we do what we can. You know, we're always cognizant of the fact that we're white people raising Alaska Native children. But hopefully through the resources in the community and through other efforts and, you know, sources of contact out there, you know, we can try to keep them connected to their culture because it's definitely really, really important, I feel. So.
So it definitely changes your world, but it's, you know, certainly for the positive, but going from being able to exercise every day, you know, and going out and getting some sun at lunchtime to, you know, driving to daycare in the morning and then working as much as you can until you can go pick them up from daycare. But
yeah,
but you do get to get fed gingerbread cookies like this. Thank you, Olive.
That was Paula Dobbin and John Reed of Anchorage, the proud parents of 2.5-year-old Olive and 9-month-old Drew. This is Kids These Days, and we're talking about adoption today. Carrie Lee Peets, you're in Juneau on the phone. I'd like to invite you to comment on some of the ideas that we heard from that family, in particular about, you know, how they put such an important value on connecting their two girls to their birth Alaska Native culture.
Yeah, I really love the input they provide in that interview because I really think that something the Office of Children's Services has focused on for our kids and our families with the help of Facing Foster Care in Alaska, our youth alumni organization, and other groups that we've really looked at how important culture is for children and for youth. And we're really fortunate in Alaska because we have amazing tribal partners that really have stepped up to the plate to provide information, and we have active dance groups in many, many communities, and there are a lot of opportunities for our children and our youth to participate and learn about their tribal culture and their family history and all of those pieces. But it really is very, very important, as Paula and her family talked about, that it's an investment for the adoptive parent. And Paula really talked about how important she knew it was and that it really was something that they've invested in. And I think that is really an important aspect to look at. And even for a young child who may not have the questions yet as they grow older, that's all going to change. And they're going to have lots of questions about their own culture and their birth family and what their situation was, what that brought them into the adoption world. So I love that idea. I think the culture piece is so important for our kids and for our youth, and just really giving them those opportunities to know where they come from and know who they are.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Blanning and Dr. Susan Bomolaski from Catholic Social Services, how does your organization prepare prospective adoptive parents for transracial adoption? Because this happens in your agency with some frequency?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We actually work with a lot of Alaska Native birth parents. So that's something that we see very often. So that's an issue that we talk about from the very beginning. If a family is interested in adopting a child that is of a different culture, they need to have some skills to be able to do that really successfully. And the first skill is being able to provide that information and the culture to the child. So that as the child gets older, they have a real sense of identity, and that identity is going to be half that of their birth culture and then half that of the adoption to family, and they need to have both of those. They're both equally as important. And then also preparing the child to, you know, face the world. Unfortunately, they may not always be treated as equally as, you know, those of us wish that they would be. And they may have to face somebody saying something very inappropriate to them. And the family needs to have that really open relationship with the child to be able to, you know, talk about it with the child and help them process that, because it's not something that maybe the adoptive parents ever had to experience, but their child may, and they need to be ready for that.
Mm-hmm. Susan, did you have some thoughts?
Well, I thought it was really interesting. They talked about the use of Facebook and email for contact as well as the face-to-face visits, and that's something that we're seeing a lot, more so as it becomes social media is so much more prevalent. And it is a way to keep the families connected culturally and in other ways when they don't live near each other. So I think that's really important. And it does add challenges to the work that that you do, and we're moving more and more into that area. But I thought the points that they made were great.
I think it's important in the time that we have left to also ask about the financial component to adopting. And I'll look first to you ladies from the Catholic Social Services. It is expensive. I mean, I guess that's a value judgment, but it costs some money to adopt mm-hmm. through your organization. So maybe you can tell us about, you know, what that range is, and also why is that money part of the adoption process?
Sure. And we look at our fees kind of continuously and compare ourselves with other, you know, we're part of the Catholic Charities Network, so we compare our fees there. And also there are for-profit adoption agencies. We're a nonprofit. And I think what you've heard in this conversation is how much of, I mean, Sarah's dedicated to this almost full time, as is our pregnancy support counselor, as are other staff. So it has to cover our staff costs. And over the last few years, we have come up with a sliding scale. So we have a base fee, and it's I think the base is around $9,000, and then there's a percent of income that adds up to that. So our adoptions are in the range of about $13,000 to $21,000. I'm sorry, we just adjusted that. So
$13,000 to $21,000.
Yes. Now there is an adoption credit when people file their taxes. That's about $11,000. I'm being corrected here, 13, so things have gone up in the last couple of years. But we try to make it affordable while covering our costs, and we do spend time on that. And, you know, we explain it to the parents, you know, that are coming in, the adoptive families that are coming in and looking at that. And certainly that's a consideration, too, that I'm sure Carrie Lee would add in there. You know, if finances are a consideration, you might choose a different adoption route. And that's kind of the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm.
Carrie Lee, you have enough time to give a last word, I think, this hour, and maybe about that.
Well, and I would say, you know, the Office of Children's Services is not an adoption agency. We're a protection agency, and our goal is to have children be safe and have families be strong and have them stay together whenever possible. But adoption can be a very expensive opportunity for families. Adoption definitely brings with it its share of different struggles for kids at all different ages, and so there are definitely going to be some ongoing struggles and needs that families have, and that's part of what we talk about when a family calls to inquire about adoption, is that there are different systems to do it and to understand kind of what those costs are associated with. In the Office of Children's Services, there isn't a fee per se to adopt, but again, we're looking at children who come from abusive or neglectful situations, and so they bring with them some additional struggles and challenges that they'll have to face throughout their life because of their own history. And so it definitely is an area that families need to be aware of, and families really need to consider all of those expenses that go with raising children and the services that they want. So I think it's there's not a fee through the Office of Children's Services, but it definitely is something that children and families need to consider as they're looking at adoption as an option.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. I'd like to thank all three of you for being with us today on the program. Dr. Susan Bomolaski is the Executive Director of Catholic Social Services in Alaska, an organization that arranges adoptions across the state. Sarah Blanning also works with Catholic Social Services as the coordinator for the infant adoption and the child waiting programs there. And Carrie Lee Peets works for the state of Alaska's Office of Children's Services and the work that they do there with fostering and adopting children. I'd like to thank all three of you women for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
At kidsthesedays.org, we'll link you to Catholic Social Services website and to the Alaska Adoption Exchange, which provides information about public and private adoption opportunities. Not all adoptions involve a long application process or a home study. Some are more a formalization of how a family is already working, like when a step-parent adopts their spouse's child. KTD contributor Jessica Cochran has more.
Timber Kirkpatrick's parents, Kara and Mike, got married. Mike vowed to Timber to always be a part of her life. Afterward, the 5-year-old girl had a question. Why hadn't her name changed, too? Kara says she wanted her daughter to wait until she was a little older to make a decision about whether Mike should adopt her. But Timber wouldn't wait.
And so I asked Timber to ask Mike when he came home if that was something he'd be interested in. And he was like, of course I want to adopt you. You know, he's like, you're mine, basically. So, we just talked to her biological father, and he said, absolutely. And signed off his rights, and then we went to court.
Timber, now 13, has called Mike dad since she was 2 years old. Now she has a 6-year-old brother, Harper. She no longer remembers the adoption process, and she's never questioned the decision.
Because I know that he cares more than my bio dad does, so there's never really a question to it.
As Timber's adopted dad, Mike has access to her medical and school records, access he wouldn't have as her stepfather. It's made travel easier for their family. When Timber was 3, she and Kara went to Mexico after some hassle to clear up paperwork. They needed a notarized letter from her biological father giving permission for her to go.
I don't even know where he's at. Like, I was so upset. And so that was a very big thing for us, is to be able to go on vacation out of the country and not have to worry about finding him to get a notarized letter saying it's okay to take her. Like, she's our child. Like, we're going to take her wherever we want.
In her family's case, her bio dad is welcome to see her if he wants to, and his relatives are very much a part of her life.
And we see all the family, like his mother and brothers and everybody else. We see them quite often. He's not really in the picture.
Every summer I go to go see my grandparents, and then most of my uncles live in Anchorage, so I see them pretty often. It's nice being able to see my family.
Yeah, and they treat Harper, I mean, there's no relation at all, but they treat him like a grandson, or a nephew, so that's pretty cool,
yeah.
You know.
Attorney Stephen Pridell says it's not unusual for grandparents and other relatives to stay in touch after a biological parent is more or less removed from parenthood. For a step-parent to adopt, the biological parent, for the most part, gives up their rights and responsibilities for the child. They'll no longer be liable for child support, for instance. That's done when they consent to the process, or if the court decides their consent isn't needed.
One of the things that parents have to think about is, when's the last time that biological parent provided either some support for the child or meaningfully communicated with the child? And if a lot of time has passed, and in Alaska it's generally a year or more, then it's possible that a court will allow you to argue that the consent of that biological parent may not be required.
Biological parents must be given notice of hearings, which can be tricky if that parent isn't in the picture. Sometimes a notice in a newspaper can be used. At the hearing, judges question the parents, and if the child is 10 years old or older, they'll be questioned too. Arrangements can give the biological parents some rights to visit, or they can sever all connections.
There are also parents that have committed domestic violence and other, you know, bad acts, and there are some parents that don't really want that other person to be around for a various number of reasons, and it's kind of peaceful for some families to get the adoption done, because then they're not worried that somebody's going to come that's a biological parent at any time and do something, because they may have some rights too.
Pridell says family law has changed to keep up with changing family structures. When a gay couple has a child, the non-biological parent often adopts the child. A parent and a grandparent might adopt a child.
You know, the definition of families really is changing over the years. It is instead of who's the biological parent, it really is who is the person or persons who are in the child's life.
Pradell says courts recognize that's what's important. I'm Jessica Cochran.
The Alaska Family Law Self-Help Center has the forms and instructions for step-parent adoption on its website. We'll link you to that from kidsthesedays.org. Kids These Days is produced by Sarah Gonzalez, who is also our business manager, our web content editor, and online media producer, and also a frequent contributor to the broadcast. Jessica Cochran is a regular contributor and our technical editor. Our theme music is composed and performed by Lost Lander. Don't forget to come see us before we're back with a new show next week. Keep the conversation going online all the time at kidstheseDays.org. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. Thanks so much for joining me today, and I'll see you next time.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guest, and contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidstheseDays.org.